Hello, everybody, and welcome to the first official episode of Killer Cast. Guys, it is happening. The first episode. I'm so excited. So anyway, for anybody who doesn't know, my name is Skylar. I'm just some weird sick freak who finds true crime interesting, and I like to share it with other people. So here I am. I'm all by myself for this first episode, but we're here, and that is what matters. And first episode is a badass achievement, if you ask me. I'm just happy that all the hard work I've put into this will be paying off, and I really appreciate you guys listening. So let's get into it. I'm so excited to talk about this case today. It was not my original choice for my first case, but I was like, I have to bring something really good to the table. This is my first episode, and this case always sends me like spiraling. So, it is an oldie but a goodie, and our case today is Bible John. Before I get started, I do just want to give a quick trigger warning. This is a true crime case, so, there will be mentions of sexual assault, rape, violence, murder, suicide, and other things along those lines, so if you think you might be sensitive to something like that, it's probably not the best idea to listen. So just proceed with caution. I don't want anybody to be hurt. Okay, so let's get into it, shall we? For anyone who doesn't know, Bible John is a serial killer who has never been caught. Bible John is just the name that he was given. And he is known for killing three young women in Glasgow, Scotland, between the years 1968 and 1969. We'll get in a little more depth later as to why he's called Bible John, but all you really need to know for now is that that is his name. That is what we know him as. So, our case starts on February 22nd, 1968, with a 25-year-old mother named Patricia Docker. Patricia was a nurse and had a young 4-year-old son named Sandy. Patricia and Sandy both lived with Patricia's parents in Battlefield, which is like kind of like a district, I guess you could say, of Glasgow. I'm not from the UK, so I don't really know how their systems work over there, but I think it's just a district. Her and Sandy's dad were going through a separation at the time, so that's why they were living with Patricia's parents. It's worth noting that she was petite and had brown hair and brown eyes. That will be important later, so just kind of keep that in the back of your head. On this night, Patricia had decided that she wanted to go out dancing and left Sandy at home with her parents. She had told her parents she was going to the Majestic Ballroom, which was kind of like a dance hall, but somehow, whether she changed her mind or just ended up heading somewhere else instead, she ended up at the Barrowland Ballroom, which is a different dance hall. Also, if I'm getting these names wrong, please let me know. I'm probably going to suck at pronouncing literally everything in this. But anyway, the Barrowland Ballroom is not just your average dance hall. It was known for being a bit on the sketchy side and was known to be a little more risque, I guess you could say. So this was a Thursday night, and on Thursday nights at the Barrowland, there was an over 25s night, and it was also labeled as the grab a granny night, which is gross as fuck. To like talk about older women like that, I feel like that is so disrespectful, but you know, I guess that's just how things were back then. So Thursday was also labeled as grab a granny night because older women frequented on that night. On these nights, many of the people attending would want to stay anonymous and may use fake names or pseudonyms. This is because they were often there to cheat on their husbands and wives, find people to hook up with. So I just kind of want to make that noted, not to like speak badly on the place or anything, but just kind of to set the scene. Like, it was known for being a little more on like the sleazier side, different than like the other dance halls around. So Patricia goes out that night, but unfortunately she does not return home. The next day, her body was discovered only a matter of yards from her home. Patricia was found laying on her back with her head purposefully turned to the right, and there were ligature marks on her neck, which points to strangulation. She was most likely strangled with a belt, but there was no weapon left at the scene. I guess you could call it a weapon. So they're not entirely sure. She was completely naked when she was found, and none of her belongings were with her body, except just one of her shoes, which led police to believe that she had been murdered somewhere else, most likely in a car, and then her body was dumped there. It had also been discovered that Patricia was menstruating at the time of her death. Now, that may not seem like super important, but it'll definitely make sense later, so try to remember that. She had been violently raped and beaten in the head and face, and her menstrual pad was placed next to her body. It is estimated that she died within just a couple hours of leaving the Berlin, which is so, so sad. Since there was really nothing for them to go on, being that forensic technology was not what you would call advanced back then, and all of her items were gone, police just kind of started going door to door, asking if anyone had seen or heard anything. And the most they got was one woman said that she heard someone screaming, "Let me go," like, "Let go of me," something along those lines. And another woman said she saw a car, but she couldn't give a make or model. So with that, you know, there's not really much that they're getting from that at all. And to make matters worse, when the police talked to Patricia's parents, they had thought she went to the Majestic Ballroom because that's where she said she was going. So the police wasted a lot of time in the beginning of the investigation at the complete wrong dance hall, and then only later found out that she had actually gone to the Berlin Ballroom. And one source I heard that they only spent 3 days investigating the Majestic Ballroom. In another source, I heard that it was a couple weeks, so I'm not gonna, like, quote how long it was or anything. Yeah, different sources say different things, but they ended up wasting time that they could have been investigating in the right place at the wrong place. So later on, they had sent divers into the River Cart to look for her belongings because it was a nearby river, but it turned out they found nothing, and the police tried to interview workers and guests of the Berlin, but some of them refused to interview, probably due to the fact that they didn't want others to know that they were there. And the people who agreed to interview were too drunk to remember anything. So basically, they were at another dead end as far as leads go. Now, they did end up checking the river cart a second time and actually found Patricia's handbag. They also searched another smaller body of water near where Patricia was found and discovered her watch there. It is thought that maybe the killer had forgotten to take it off, and then when he was dumping the body, he kind of noticed, took it off, and threw it in the water. So they found her watch there, and they found the bag, but other than that, they never discovered her clothing or her jewelry. At this point, the case started to go cold. The police had nothing more to go on, and there was no one coming forward with leads. And at this point, the police had no reason to believe that this was the beginning of a series of killings. About a year and a half later, things had been pretty quiet, and then another murder. The body of 32-year-old single mother of three, Jemima McDonald, was found Monday, August 18th, 1969. Jemima was known to frequent the Berlin Ballroom. I swear, I cannot say this. And the Saturday before she was found, she had left her kids with her sister Margaret O'Brien, and then she set out for the Berlin. Sunday morning rolls around and Jemima is still nowhere to be seen. However, Margaret doesn't start to panic yet. She seems to understand that maybe Jemima just met a guy she liked and went home with him, or maybe just stayed out with some friends, and she should be home in no time. Day turns to night, and still, Margaret is like, where the hell is Jemima? And there's no sign of her. So about 24 hours after Jemima had left, Margaret had started hearing rumors that some local kids in the neighborhood had broken into an abandoned building at the end of a street, and they found a dead body. Everyone pretty much just brushed it off and attributed it to, like, kids just being kids, and Margaret kind of felt the same way at first, too. She was kind of like, you know, they're probably just, like, playing, like, a joke or whatever, but she couldn't really help but wonder, and it was getting late, so she heads to bed for the night and can't stop thinking about this abandoned building. So the next morning, Margaret wakes up, gets directions from one of the local kids, and heads to this abandoned building herself. At 7 a.m. Monday morning, unfortunately, Jemima's body was discovered by her own sister, Margaret. Unlike Patricia, Jemima's body was found lying face down and fully clothed, apart from her tights, which were found next to her body with her shoes. However, her clothes were very disheveled and she did have ligature marks on her neck, and it is believed that she was strangled with her own tights. Similarly, Jemima was also on her period when she died, and her pad was also displayed purposefully next to her body. She had also been raped and violently beaten in the head and face, just like Patricia. At the time her body was found, Jemima had been dead around 30 hours, meaning that she was also likely not killed far after leaving the Barrel Inn, late Saturday night or very early Sunday morning. The Barrel Inn, after this murder, put Jemima's face up on the big screen at the ballroom just to refresh people's memories, and they even offered for people's identity to be anonymous if they could come forward with any information at all. They had a police officer who resembled Jemima put on similar clothes to what she was wearing to see if anyone recognized her. Out of this, only two witnesses came forward, but that is better than what they were working with before. So the information gathered told them that around 7 p.m., Jemima arrived at the Barrel Inn Ballroom and started talking to a handsome man almost immediately. He was described as well-spoken, well-dressed, which was kind of strange, just because the Barrel Inn wasn't known for being, like, a formal place. It was always more, like, casual attire. You know, he kind of stood out a little bit. He had reddish hair. He was about 6 feet tall with a slim build and looked to be about 25 to 35. She was dancing and drinking with him all night, and then she and the mystery man left together. No one recognized the man, so he wasn't a regular, but the people that did see him agreed to help make a police sketch, and I will post that on the Instagram, along with some other photos pertaining to the case, just so you guys can kind of see what they look like as you go along with the case. But anyway, a few weeks after Jemima's body was found, the police said the two cases may be connected, but they didn't say that they officially were. The police sketch had started to circulate, and I actually read that this was the first police sketch in the UK to be put on the news and, like, in the papers and all over, which I think is pretty fucking cool, actually. That seems like kind of a big moment. Jemima's parents even offered a cash award for anyone who could provide info leading to an arrest. However, nothing came of that, and the police sketch looked too plain to be able to really use it to identify someone, so nothing really came of that either. Then, October 31st, 1969, the naked body of Helen Puddock, a 29-year-old married mother of two, was discovered by a man walking his dog in a field behind a couple of houses. Familiarly, she had been beaten in the head and face violently. She was strangled with her own tights and raped. And you guys will never guess this, but she was on her period. This time, however, her pad was tucked under her arm. I think this might have been just because she was outside and maybe the killer didn't want it to blow away. Maybe it was like a motive of some sort and like he didn't want it like being away from the crime scene because it's like his trademark or whatever. I don't know. He's a sick freak. So I don't know what his motive was, but I think he just didn't want it to blow away. And the contents of her purse were spilled out in a trail leading away from her body, but the bag itself was taken from the scene. And y'all, this is the saddest fucking thing, but Helen had grass stains on her knees. Now that makes me really sad because like it just makes you think like she was fighting, but also like hella proud of our girl Helen. Like she was a fighter and she tried to get away from this sicko, and it's unfortunate that she didn't make it out, but there was a cufflink reportedly found at the scene, and it's believed that Helen ripped it off of him while she was fighting back. And I just have to say, what a bad bitch Helen is, because she really did the damn thing and she tried her hardest and she was putting up a fight. And it is sad that it wasn't, you know, ultimately enough in the end, but good on Helen. So something that makes Helen different is that she had a bite mark on her wrist. Now, normally, being, like, a true crime freak, I would, like, start jumping up and down for joy because, like, a bite mark, like, everybody knows, like, bite marks, they can get you. Like, they got Ted Bundy with that shit. They can get you with a bite mark. But it turned out that it wasn't just one bite mark. It was three overlapping. So it was next to impossible to be able to differentiate the shapes of the teeth. At this point, the police officially link all three cases and announce that they are looking for a serial killer who is targeting women from the Maryland ballroom, especially those who were petite with brown hair and brown eyes. I told you that was important. They all were petite with brown hair and brown eyes. The police did an interview with Helen's parents, who said she had gone out to the Maryland with her sister Jeannie the night before. Jeannie's husband was watching all the kids so the sisters could go out that night together. According to the family, Jeannie and Helen left around 6:30 and stopped at a local pub or a bar for some drinks and then headed toward the Maryland. As soon as they arrived, Jeannie had caught the eye of a man and they were spending the night dancing together, kind of leaving Helen like to do her own thing for the most part. And then out of nowhere, a man bumps into her and, you know, he's just the most polite thing in the world. His name is John. He introduced himself as John. And they end up spending the entire night together and even paired up with Jeannie and her date for the night. So they sat as a group of four at a table. Jeannie was able to get an extremely good look at this guy from being around him all night long. And if you can guess how she described him, you'd be right. Tall, red hair, slim build, in his 20s or 30s, dressed super nice. She said he was very polite and charming, and she also said one of his teeth overlapped the other in the top row. However, later on in the night, she said he got like super aggressive out of nowhere when a cigarette machine ate his money, and in true Karen fashion, John goes all out drama queen and starts asking for the manager, and he apparently didn't stop causing a scene until the manager gave him his little minuscule amount of money back. Now, I know everybody's got their struggles and stuff, but John, like, how are you just gonna go all Karen on the manager over a cigarette machine? Priorities, boy. But I mean, who am I to even say anything? Like, he's killing people, so obviously I don't know why I expect him to be a functioning member of society. Anyway, after the night was over, Jeannie's man went ahead and peaced out and went to catch his train, and so just Jeannie, John, and Helen were left. Apparently John lived super close to Helen, so they agreed to all take a cab home together. Jeannie was going to be dropped off first, and then Helen, and then John. But here's the thing. So Jeannie actually lived the furthest away, and naturally you'd think that she'd be dropped off last. But you know good old gentleman John, he goes, oh no, please, I insist, and says he wants Jeannie and Helen dropped off before him so they aren't in the taxi alone. Like, how chivalrous of him. Like, what a man. What a man that John is. And that is until they are in the taxi, and he starts being super weird and talking about just, like, the Bible the whole time, but, like, not in, like, a nice, friendly way. Like, he's telling them, like, weird-ass stories. But yeah, that's how he got his name. There's the namesake, Bible John, because he said his name was John, and he talks about the Bible. It's that simple. Could have told you that in the beginning, but I made you wait for it. But I guess he never actually quoted verses or anything. He'd just, like, bring up stories. But according to Jeannie, John was saying all these things about how the Barrowland is a den of iniquity. And then homeboy starts quoting the Old Testament and tells Jeannie and Helen a story about a woman who was stoned to death for being unfaithful to her husband. So the girls were like, weird flex, but okay. And, like, the car got super awkward. So apparently John picked up on that and decided to swiftly change the subject to golf, which, you know, is just everyone's favorite subject. I know I love to talk about golf. So, yeah, you know what? Actually, golf podcast coming out next Monday. Screw this. Jeannie says she did drink, but she remembers the night extremely well. And she said she remembers John saying his last name, and it was something like Templeton, Simpleson, or Emerson. She was also able to give the police enough information about how he looked that they were able to come up with a brand new, slightly better sketch, which is also on the Instagram. As you'll see, he has bright red hair in this sketch, but some of the other witnesses from that night describe him as having brown hair. I think there could be confusion because of, like, dark lighting. Like, sometimes red hair does look brown whenever it's dark out. And maybe they confused him for the man that Jeannie was with. Could really be anything. Maybe it just wasn't him. I don't know. So the police put out the sketch, and it is all over the news. There were hundreds of leads, and since he was so, like, I hate to, you know, say it, but he was just, like, plain looking, I guess. Anyone who looked like the sketch at all were having rumors started about them. Everyone was on the lookout for this redheaded serial killer, and people were afraid. So, you know, you have, like, people making accusations. If you were a redhead back then, like, I would not want to have been you. If you were, like, 6 feet tall and had red hair, no, wouldn't want to have been you. Because he was wearing a suit, all 250 tailors were called from the area to interview, and 453 barbers in Glasgow were interviewed as well. No one recognized this mystery man from the sketch, and they were making effort after effort to find this man. The police even went undercover at the Barrowland, and nothing came up there either. By the end of the year, they had at least 5,000 suspects, and all of them checked out clear. After Helen's murder, the killing stopped, and people all wondered who Bible John was, and ultimately, where did he go? The police believed for some reason that his mom was hiding him. I could not find why they thought that. Like, it's just, like, a couple different sites I saw just said that. They were like, oh, the police think his mom's hiding him. So, I'm not sure. I guess maybe just, like, a mother's instinct to protect their kid, maybe? I don't know. Some believed he either joined or was already in the army, and some think he might have died or even be in prison for another crime. Some wonder if the murders are even connected at all, so, like, that's a whole different thing. But I can see what they mean, like, being, like, all the murders were in different towns in Glasgow, so, like, he would have to almost be an expert at these three particular towns. He'd have to know things like back roads, rivers, streams, like, I don't know. I mean, it's possible he was maybe, like, a person of authority, maybe, like, a police officer or something, and had, like, some kind of map for the cities. But some people theorize that for one man to know exactly where the river was to dump Patricia's purse, and to know exactly where the abandoned building was, where Jemima was found, and the weird little field area where Helen was. Like, a lot of people think that's really unlikely that one guy would know all of that. And they also think that since Patricia was strangled with a belt and the others were strangled with their own tights, that the last two weren't the same man as the first murder. Some people say Helen's murder was weird because of her having a bite mark. Like, there's lots of theories. I don't necessarily agree or disagree, but I believe that maybe he just had some kind of map or something to help him get around. And I personally do feel like it was all the same guy, but I could be wrong. I'm not here to give you my personal beliefs. I'm here to give you the facts, kids. So I could be wrong. Anyway, though, the police and the public have so many unanswered questions at this point, and the general consensus, at least, is that all these crimes were committed by one man. But, like, why did he do this? Was it sexually motivated? Was it anger towards women? Some Catholic men do think that it's sinful to menstruate, which, can we be real for a second? Like, you wouldn't be here if it weren't for menstruation, sir. But some people do believe that way. But then you have to wonder, how did he know they were on their period? Did he maybe try to hook up with them and they said no because they were either because they were on their period, and like maybe he just got pissed off and had anger because girls were rejecting him because of their period? I don't know. Maybe he noticed they were wearing like a sanitary belt. And if you don't know what that is, like, back in the day, like, pads used to be pretty big, and women would wear like a type of belt to kind of like hold them up. So he might have felt their sanitary belt. It could just be a coincidence, I guess, but I feel like for the pad to be on display like that, there had to be some kind of reason. But with serial killers and fucked up people, you don't always really know. There could be literally no reason, and he just wanted to be a sicko. And like I said earlier, the people who recalled seeing him did say he would often reference Bible stories, but the kicker is, he oftentimes wouldn't even get them right. Like the story he told Jeannie and Helen about the woman being stoned to death? Yeah, not true. Not true. Apparently in the story, Jesus actually prevents them from stoning the woman to show that everyone sins and no one is an exception. So, not to judge her for her sins when they also commit them. I think maybe he just wanted to use the Bible as some sort of personality trait or give him a reason to quote-unquote justify his killings. There are literally so many reasons we could come up with as to why he would do all this, but maybe he had no reason at all. Could be a religious motive, could be, you know, because the people at the Barrel Inn were mostly unfaithful. Maybe he just didn't handle rejection well. I don't know. But moving on. So, doing a little more research, apparently a man was arrested who matched Bible John's description, and he was arrested for, get this, this man was arrested for screaming at a woman at the Barrowland Ballroom, and he also gave the police a fake name and address. For hours, he insisted that the fake information was real, and then finally, he gave the police his actual information, and they were looking at him as Bible John, but ended up releasing him because he didn't have an overlapping front tooth. So then, this joker gets arrested again and gave a fake name again, and this time his fake name was John White. But John is a common name, so maybe it's a coincidence, maybe not, I don't know. But police ended up releasing him again and started looking elsewhere. The next lead police would have would be almost 30 years later in 1996. At this point, the suspect was already dead. His name was John Irvine McInnes. He was a local army man, and in 1980, he committed suicide by slicing an artery in his upper arm and bleeding out. Obviously, forensics had come a long way since 1969, and they were able to test semen samples from Helen. However, they did not match McInnes' DNA, so now we have cleared him. The last, and final suspect is actually another well-known serial killer who I totally plan to do an episode on. So if you guys want to hear an episode about him, please let me know. But his name's Peter Tobin. And I won't get in, like, to super, like, I won't get super in-depth about him, but he is relevant, so here we are. Peter Tobin is a serial killer that we see first in 2006 when the body of a girl was discovered under the floorboards of a church he worked in. Her name was, I'm going to get this wrong, guys. Her name was Angelica Kluk, I believe, and she was 22 years old. She was beaten, raped, and stabbed to death. They quickly got a DNA sample and found it matched to Peter Tobin, who was 60 years old at the time. The police didn't believe this was his first murder at all. They said it seemed like he had done this before because he was, like, kinda smartish about it. He only made one tiny mistake with removing DNA. He hid the body well. He knew how to murder. And Peter Tobin would soon after be connected to at least three murders. Those murders are Angelica Kluk, Vicky Hamilton, and either Dinah or Dina McNichol. His victims were very similar to Bible John's, and his exes said that he looked like the sketch at the age he would have been when it was drawn. Does that make sense? Yes. So, like, whenever he was in his 20s or 30s, he would have looked like the sketch. And Jeannie swears up and down that Peter Tobin is not the man that she saw that night, though. And she is, like, the most reliable witness. His exes also said that he would get violent and sexual when they were on their periods. One ex, which I don't even want to call her an ex and attach her name to this slime ball, so we'll just call her a victim. So the victim even said that Peter Tobin imprisoned her for a year and beat and raped her constantly and even mutilated her genitals at one point. He was Catholic, like Bible John, and he used upwards of 500 fake names. One of his common ones was John Simple, which sounds a lot like John Simpleson, doesn't it? Like what I was saying earlier, like Jeannie said it was like Templeton or Simpleson or Emerson. Yeah, John Simple sounds a lot like John Simpleson, but that's none of my business. But he doesn't fit the height description because he is only 5'6" and he has brown hair. And also, Bible John never used weapons, and Peter Tobin always used a weapon. But he did live in Glasgow at the time and moved at the end of 1969. He has a front tooth that has been removed, which could have been overlapping. And a woman did say she was raped by Peter at the Berlin Ballroom in 1968. But then you have all the things pointing away from it, like the weapons thing. He hid bodies. Bible John left them in the open. Peter's semen did not match, but the sample is old, so maybe it could be wrong. The most recent update I could find on Peter Tobin is in an article from Daily Record on March 5th, 2021, which basically said that a prison pal of Tobin's said that Peter admitted to killing 10 women, but says, quote, "People just think I'm Bible John, but I'm not. It wasn't me. Nothing to do with me. I didn't kill them." Unquote. He said of the 10 women he's killed, one still hasn't been found in Brighton. As of today, Peter Tobin is rotting in prison and is allegedly suffering with cancer, strokes, and/or heart attacks. So, I mean, maybe don't, like, rape and murder people and I'll feel bad for you, but I just don't feel bad. So sorry, not sorry, Peter. But anyway, that is the case of Bible John. If we get any updates or deathbed confessions or anything like that, I'll be sure to post like an update episode. But for now, that is all I have. And I do also want to point out that I'm definitely not the expert of everything, and true crime is something I find really fascinating, and I like to share it with my family and friends, and I guess whoever will listen to this. But I'm not perfect, and if I get something wrong, please feel free to tell me, because I do fuck up sometimes. I'm just a human. But I hope you guys have enjoyed the very first Can I talk? I hope you guys have enjoyed the very first episode of Killer Cast. So be sure to follow me on Instagram at KillerCastPodcast, Twitter at KillerCastPod. Oh, and also follow me on TikTok. I think that's KillerCastPod as well. Thanks. Bye, y'all.